The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to the Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and thanks so much for being here. We feature many leaders from national and international organizations on the program, but I sometimes think we don't spend enough time highlighting those nonprofits that serve New York exclusively. So that is what we're going to do tonight with two organizations who have a physical fitness focus, but who provide their participants so much more. You'll first hear from Amanda Krause, the founder and CEO of Row New York, who will tell you what the organization was created to do.
Well, I started Row New York about 15 years ago, and the mission was and still is to bring competitive rowing and academic support to young people from under-resourced communities in New York City, and not just young people from under-resourced communities, but people from all different backgrounds, socioeconomic backgrounds, and with all sorts of abilities and disabilities.
And then I will be joined by Anna Reyes, founder and president of I Challenge Myself, who also uses sport to lift people up. But first, the Business Giving News Digest for Sunday, February 17th.
So I Challenge Myself's mission is to use cycling and fitness to help students develop socially, academically, and physically.
The Museum of Modern Art has announced an unrestricted gift of more than $200 million from the estate of David Rockefeller, who died in 2017 at the age of 101. Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts in New York City has announced the appointment of Henry Timms, executive director of the 92nd Street Y, as its new president and CEO. Contributions to U.S. colleges and universities reached a record $47 billion in fiscal year 2018, a 4.6% increase over the previous year. The technology company eBay says it raised $102 million from charities in 2018 compared to $84 million in 2017. Sellers can designate a charity to receive a portion of their sales. Buyers can choose to give when they make a purchase, and charities can use the site to sell goods and market charity events. A new study suggests that for each dollar a restaurant invested in food waste, it saved roughly $7. And in the last generation, arrests of California teenagers have fallen by 80%. Murder arrests by 85%, gun killings by 75%, imprisonments by 88%, teen pregnancy down 75%, school dropouts have been halved, and college enrollments are up by 45%. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back to speak with Amanda Krause right after this.
Most teachers spend over $500 of their own money every year on school supplies because classrooms lack books, art supplies, even pencils. At DonorsChoose.org, you can help schools get the resources they need most. Bring a classroom dream to life. Visit DonorsChoose.org. Welcome back to the Business of Giving with Denver Frederick.
There are many activities that engage youth from underserved communities that help to change the trajectory of their lives. Basketball and track, of course. Many listeners may even be familiar with fencing or chess, but you don't hear quite as much about rowing. But you should, and you're about to, from Amanda Krause, the founder and executive director of Row New York. Good evening, Amanda, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Good evening. Thank you for having me here.
Tell us about the mission of Row New York and what the organization was created to do.
Well, I started Row New York about 15 years ago. And the mission was and still is to bring competitive rowing and academic support to young people from under-resourced communities in New York City. And not just young people from under-resourced communities, but people from all different backgrounds, socioeconomic backgrounds, and with all sorts of abilities and disabilities. So really the idea is to use the sport of rowing to launch people into college, successful careers, being engaged with their communities, strength, et cetera. And that was the goal in the beginning and continues to be now.
And as you mentioned, the organization was founded, I think it was in 2002. Mm-hmm. But it was really birthed a couple years earlier up in Boston,
right,
where you went to school. So share with us a little bit about the founding story.
Yeah. So I always say that Row New York really was inspired by a small group of girls in Boston. And when I was in, I went to graduate school at Harvard at the School of Education, and I started working part-time for community rowing up there just as a part-time job. And there was a new program there called Girls Row Boston, which brought competitive rowing to low-income girls in Boston. And I pretty much fell in love with that program within the first couple of weeks of working there and was so inspired by the girls in that group and found myself spending a lot more time with them than I did at school, in graduate school, because I was so much more interested in the progress that they were making and the learning that was going on with them on the water, on the water or in we started doing little study groups together. I taught them to swim. We brought in nutritionists. We, they learned to train and to get fit. And then they actually started racing together in the spring. And like I said, I was just so much more sort of inspired and interested in what was happening on the Charles River than what was happening at Harvard. And they were that group of girls, and I can still picture them, you know, crystal clear in my head, were the inspiration for starting Row New York. Because when I finished graduate school, my husband, he was my boyfriend at the time, he was finishing graduate school too up there. And I'm originally from New York City, and I knew that I wanted to come back to New York and be near my family. And it was actually his suggestion was, why don't you start the same thing but in New York City? Which at the time seemed like a terrible suggestion because there was no infrastructure for setting up a rowing organization in New York City. We, unlike, a city like Chicago or Boston or Philadelphia, where there's a lot of infrastructure and boathouses, we just didn't have that in New York City. So I thought that's a terrible idea because we don't have any money. There's no money for this idea. Yeah, we had debt. Exactly. Not only did we not have money, right? We had worse than no money. We had debt to graduate school. And, but, I mulled it over and thought, I've seen this work. I've seen this model, this program work, unlike I've seen anything work. And if I could replicate this in New York City, I know it would be successful.
Mm-hmm. The disparity between the poor and the well-to-do has always left an impression on you. I remember reading about walking through Washington Square Park when you were a girl. That's always been with you, correct?
Yeah. I think, I grew up in New York City. And, was lucky enough to really live. I lived in New York City in a time it's changed so much, right? I never went east of Second Avenue. Mm-hmm. I didn't, you weren't really safe walking through Washington Square Park, but still my parents somehow let my brother and I take that walk down to school every day. But I was lucky enough to, have food security and have a lovely home to live in and a good school to go to. But I was always just very aware of that privilege and how lucky I was, and really just didn't understand. It never made sense to me that, why do I have so much and others, just because they were born into another family or another community, have so little, and what role can I play in trying to bring some of this abundance to others? And it's not just resources, but it goes way beyond that, and I think we experience that at Row New York all the time in terms of, we provide resources in terms of boats and SAT prep, for example. But I think there are also resources in terms of, encouragement is a resource.
Yeah,
and having, pushing someone to be stronger or faster or work harder becomes a resource.
Well, you needed some encouragement because here you are taking the leap. You're coming to New York. You're maybe 25 years old.
Right.
You have no real world experience. And
right.
You've just set up all the problems. I got no money.
Right.
I have a debt. I have no body of water.
Right.
I have no kids.
Right.
So, Amanda, where did you start?
Well, you said it right. I had, where did I start? I basically we lived in the East Village in this tiny apartment that was, I think, 300 square feet. With our two cats, and I remember getting this huge piece of paper and writing out all the things that I needed to do and hanging it on my wall in the kitchen / living room / dining room, whatever it was. And, it said everything from get nonprofit status, build a board of directors, fundraise, find a body of water, get boats, find kids. I mean, each line. And then there were some things that it would be like, buy office supplies. But then right underneath it would be something enormous, like find a place to row. And I sort of just saw it as this great big project. And I didn't really have any skills to bring to the table. I've gone through college and I've gone through graduate school. But it's amazing how much school one can go through and still not have any real skills.
Amen.
Yeah. So I realized that I would just start picking off the list, but I also realized I needed to get more people on my team, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's where having been a rower comes in, as you realize you can't do this alone unless you're rowing the single. You know, you need to find some teammates. So I did all the networking I could. I went to everything I could possibly go to that had anything to do with boats or sports or college or academics, because I didn't even have a network in New York City. And I finally started to find some people through NYC 2012, which is the group trying to bring the Olympics to New York City at the time. And they were wonderful, Dan Doktoroff, Jay Kriegel, and those guys. And they introduced me to some rowers who were a little bit older. They had jobs, so they had some money. And I said, listen, I have this idea. They'd been rowers themselves. They got it. I said, I want to bring this rowing to girls in New York City, because we were only girls at the time. Mm-hmm. I will do all the work, but I don't have any money. And they said, well, that's good, because we have some money, but we don't have any time. So it was sort of the perfect marriage. And that was the beginning of the board of directors.
Mm-hmm. How did you find a body of water?
I literally got in my car with my husband, boyfriend then, and he had been a rower too. And we drove around New York City for 2 days, mm-hmm. I think. We literally drove. We looked at the East River. We looked at the Harlem River. We went and looked at the Bronx River. We looked at Jamaica Bay. I mean, we just literally drove around the city. And we finally landed at in Flushing Meadow Park at Meadow Lake. And I still have the picture of the day that we drove up there. I don't think anyone's ever been so excited to see Meadow Lake in Queens, you know. And we both said, this is perfect. This is perfect. You know, it's somewhat protected. There's a building. It was all barricaded, so you could barely see in. We kind of looked through some cracks in the doors. It was an old one of the World's Fair buildings, mm-hmm. and it was filled with garbage and paint. But I said, this is perfect. And then the guys from NYC 2012 helped me find a connection to the Parks Department. And it took about a year to get a key to get permission to use that lake. And
and
asking the commissioner. It's all about that's
must
when
have
I
fast tracked it for you.
Exactly. Right. And that's when I had my first lesson of like it's, you know, who you know. And someone from NYC 2012 called the Parks Commissioner and said, will you meet with this woman who's trying to start this program? Things happen. Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly. So went to the Parks Commissioner for Queens at the time and said, you know, I really would love to start this rowing program for girls on this lake of yours in this park. And they won't know how to swim and the boats are narrow and we've never done this before here. And they said, okay, that's good. So luckily, permission was granted and that was the beginning. And then I called my college coach. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm starting this program. He's from New York, too. And he's a real New Yorker. He rode at New York Athletic Club, Jim Dietz. And he said, I'll bring you some boats.
All right.
So he showed up with some boats.
Yeah.
I called my dad. He bought me an outboard engine. You know, it started to come together.
Fantastic. Before we get into the program, let me ask you a little bit about rowing. I have a couple friends who row.
Yeah.
And they all tell me it's harder than it looks.
Right.
Is that the case? And if so, why is it that much harder?
The short answer is it is absolutely harder than it looks. So much harder than it looks. That said, once you know how to row, and this is sort of the beauty of the sport, you know, you can come in overweight. You cannot have any, you know, we always joke that in the office, like if you throw somebody a box of tissues and they don't catch it, they'll say, that's because I'm a rower. Like you don't need any hand-eye coordination. You just need to be able to, like, get this one stroke down. It's not like there are multiple strokes or, you know, mm-hmm. now we're going to do a different stroke. There's only one stroke.
Not like golf with a drive
right.
and a chip and a putt.
Right. And there's no different – you're not going to use a different oar mm-hmm. for a different race. Or that said, what people don't realize until they start the sport is that the boats don't naturally set up and balance. So they're very tippy. They're very narrow. And so – it takes a great deal of time to learn how basically, you know, you're keeping your body centered and powerful. And the oar is the height of the oar handle is dictating the balance of the boat.
Hmm.
So when you press the oar handle down and the blade, which is out by the water, goes up, the boat will go down to your side. And if you lift up, it comes up off of your side, uh-huh. whether you're port or starboard. And so that's fine. And you figure that out with good coaching. But then you have to recognize that there are seven other people when you're in an eight doing that. So you all have to be literally pushing down at the same exact time to the same exact height and then coming forward to the catch and lifting up at exactly the same time. And you have all these variables because you're on water and there's wind and there's current and sometimes there are, you know, white caps if it's really bad. Ideally, there are no white caps. So getting that balance is technically very challenging. And it takes a long, long time for boats to not look like a, you know, if you picture a child on training wheels mm-hmm. where it's just going from side to side, ideally you get to the point where you're not on training wheels and the blades aren't hitting the water at all.
Right in the subway without holding on to anything sometimes.
Exactly.
Going back and forth.
Right.
So how does Row New York work? Who is eligible for the program? How do they get accepted? And what does the program consist of?
Yeah, so Row New York has multiple programs. Mm-hmm. I would say that we always describe our core program is our middle school and high school after school year-round program.
Okay, let's start with that.
So those kids are with us. The middle schoolers are with us 4 days a week, 2 days a week of rowing and 2 days a week of academics. And the high schoolers are with us 6 days a week. And
high dosage, I think.
High dosage.
Yes,
we call that high dosage. Mm-hmm. And our kids, that's 270 kids in that program year-round, and that's across three on-water sites, so Queens, Brooklyn, and Manhattan, too, mm-hmm. and boys and girls. And those kids come to us from public schools, from private schools, charter schools. We mostly recruit from public schools in low-income communities. And they come to us, they learn how to swim, they do swim lessons, they lift weights, they run, they erg, they obviously learn to row and train on the water from March through around November when it gets too cold and we come off the water for the winter. And then they do academics, so small group tutoring, Regents prep, SAT prep, we visit colleges. So the kids who are with us, they're really in it, right? We estimate that our high schoolers do about 1,008 hours a year with us. And the idea is that if you're really going to transform someone's life and you're really going to move the needle, so to speak, you can't do that one or two afternoons a week. That's, you know, if you're going to train and race against other youth in the Northeast, they're training 5-6 days a week. So if you want to be competitive, that's what you need to put into the sport and into the training.
Well, let's talk about racing and competitiveness. So they
yeah.
do then compete in some.
Oh, yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So our goal has always been, you know, we didn't want to just be a program that brought the sport of rowing to kids who didn't look like all the other kids in rowing. And I'll just say it like it is. Rowing's still a very white, affluent sport. Mm-hmm. And when you, you know, just last weekend, I went to the Mid-Atlantic Indoor Rowing Championships with some of our adaptive rowers. And those are our rowers with disabilities. And I think I saw hundreds and hundreds of kids racing at this event. I saw two kids of color, not including Row New York. So it's still a very, very white, affluent sport. And so our goal was not just to make it not white. Our goal was to take kids regardless of background, regardless of ability, and help them be as fast as possible and as successful as possible on the water. Also help them academically so that they could then launch into college and stay in college and do well and go on to do all the great things that they want to do.
Did the academics come from the very outset, or was that
yes.
something you put into the program as it evolved?
Yeah. Nope. Academics have always been a part of it because you don't want to just have someone who's a super talented, strong rower
yeah.
who's not also getting the support they need in school. But yeah, from the very beginning, it's like kids, we've wanted them to be competitive. And they I mean, that's what rowing is. Rowing isn't about, you know, just going out for a paddle. It's about being as, you know, you've known rowers.
It's about winning.
It's about winning. It's
yeah.
about being as fast as you can possibly
yeah.
be. So
yeah.
You can't do that, you know, a few days a week.
Mm-hmm. Well, you sort of touched on this before, but you do have an amazing breadth of programs. Tell us about some of the others outside of your core program.
Right. I'm glad you asked because we do have wonderful other programs. We have a veterans program. And we're serving veterans from around the city, and some of them compete with our adaptive program. So some of them have disabilities, physical disabilities. Some do not have physical disabilities and just compete in our veterans program. And they train. Right now they're training on the ergs, but they'll get back on the water mm-hmm. this spring and compete. And they have so many of them have come to me and said, you know, this is the first time since – since I can remember that I felt like I'm a part of something. Like, I'm a part of this team, and we're in this together. This is so positive, too, you know. And that's those are their words, not mine. I would never, you know, say that on their behalf.
But you'll stick it in the annual report.
I sure will. And then we also have programs during the school day. We partner with District 75. So their girls, this is girls only in, at the Queens Boathouse with cognitive disabilities, will come to the boathouse during the day and we'll run their PE classes for them. So they'll be on the rowing machines, they'll get out in the training barges on the lake, and the very different goals for that program. So those girls aren't going and racing, but you know, there's a real sort of lack of access, so to speak, for physical education in our city in general, but especially kids with disabilities. So we feel we're really excited about that program and that partnership.
You're a very data-driven organization, and you measure the impact, issue a report about it. Tell us about some of the outcomes that this program has had.
Yeah, absolutely. We love to look at how we're doing and make sure we course correct along the way, so it's not just for our funders, but for ourselves as well. And we do, and we weren't always as good as we are at this, but you know, now we have someone who's wonderful, who's ahead of all of our evaluation. And so she'll report out to the whole program staff and leadership staff every month on where we are in terms of everything from attendance to GPA to fitness. You know, we track fitness, we track academics, and then we also track social emotional learning and growth.
Good.
So, you know, for instance, 99% of our kids have graduated from high school. We have about 96% going on to college. And, you know, it changes a little bit year to year, but about 92% have either graduated from college or are on track to graduate from college. And the college readiness rates are much higher than the average New York public school student. And then we also like to keep track of sort of the hours per year we provide of advisement for our students going on to college compared to the average for New York City public school students.
Who have been some of your financial supporters, partners, and how much of your revenue is philanthropic? How much of it's earned income?
Yeah. So we have an operating budget of around $5 million this year. And we've always had around 50% of our funding coming from foundations.
Mm-hmm.
Had a really good track record with foundations over the years. Been very lucky that way. And worked on, you know, finding good relationships with very generous supporters. Altman Foundation, Charles Hayden, Pinkerton, Maverick, New York Community Trust.
Good names.
Yeah. I mean, the list is long, and they've been wonderful partners. Heckscher Foundation. So, but then the next big bucket is individual funders. So we do everything from people running the half marathon or the marathon and raising money that way. We have multiple events throughout the year. We have a Harlem River Classic where people pay $5,000 a boat to race one another on the Harlem River and support Row New York. We have a young person's event that raises, you know, $40,000, $50,000. They call it the Bow Ball. We have our annual gala. So we have a lot of funding that comes in from individuals, as small as $10 donations all the way up to, you know, much, much larger checks. And the board is very involved, very active on the fundraising front. And we're very clear about that sort of from the beginning, that that's a big part of your role on the board is to really be cultivating relationships, new and old, and actively fundraising. And then we have...
Glad you set those expectations, because so many organizations don't do that and then expect it to happen by magic later
on. Exactly. Right. And we have a lot, I'd say, more people who we lose as potential board members than we get, just because we have the conversations early on. But it's good for them to know and for us to know.
Sure.
You know, we don't want no surprises, right?
Mm-hmm,
so we always say, listen, there's a give-get. We will meet one-on-one quarterly to talk about who you're cultivating. We will, of course, be helpful in that process. But the idea is board members really are expected to be very active, and our board chair leads the way on that. And then we have a small bucket of earned income. It's about $300-$350 a year.
Mm-hmm.
Which is our Scholastic Rowing League, or the participants pay to be a part of Row New York. And they row paying youth, row with the non-paying youth. So the idea is that all of our kids are actually training together, racing together, visiting colleges together. They're not separate programs.
You know, I suspect you're asked this a lot, Amanda, but concept and some very impressive impact numbers. Have you thought of taking this on the road and having Row New York become Row Chicago or Row Atlanta and doing it in some other cities?
Yeah. Excellent question. And we are asked that a lot about, you know, do we want to go somewhere else? And we did a strategic planning process a few years ago now. And that was one of the questions we asked ourselves as an organization. And the answer then was no, we are focused on New York City for now. It's a very, there's a lot of quality control. There's a lot of safety control that's necessary in our programs because we have kids on water. Obvious reasons, safety is, you know, paramount.
Yeah.
So right now we are focused, we are all in for New York City. And I could see us revisiting that in a few years. But for now, it's focused here. But we do get calls and emails from people around the country and even around the world asking for advice on, you know, getting mm-hmm. started. So we've been hosting our own show, our own podcast monthly called Waterside Chats.
Right.
Which you can find on our website. Uh-huh. We focus on metrics. The next month was fundraising. We did one on staff development for working with low-income youth. And we're holding a conference in April, too.
Fantastic. You have a pretty good-sized team now across the city. Tell us about your corporate culture and one or two things about it that you think make it an exceptional place in which to work.
Yeah. I mean, that's a fun question, and I love this topic. I think it's hard for me to be objective on that one. So, you know, you should probably ask, like, other people who work at Roe New York because this is very biased,
sure.
admittedly. But I think—
But you always say the CEO is the one who knows the least about the culture.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I'm going to.
But with that being said, give us your best shot.
Yeah, I will own that. I mean, I think when you're the founder and you're the CEO and you steer the ship, so to speak, you have, you know, culture, you have to sort of own, take responsibility for what's going well and what isn't. And I think, you know, for me, what I always value is a culture where people work really damn hard.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that absolutely happens. And I think also it's a culture where we really do encourage people, and people do it, like use your vacation time, log off on the weekends. You're not going to get an award for staying latest at night in the office or being the last to leave. Like that, this is a marathon, not a sprint, is what I always say. There will be moments of sprinting, but this is like, we're not going to win this overnight. So you have to take care of yourselves. And I think it's a culture of, you know, when someone needs help, everyone jumps up. You know, we're rowers. So yeah. if someone needs help with something, everyone jumps in and lifts that person up, whether it's they're finishing writing something or they need to research something or they're bringing boxes out to a van. No one should be sitting and watching someone else work. And I think that's definitely a part of the culture.
Your rowers. That just says it all.
Right. Exactly.
Let me close with this, Amanda, with your rededication here to New York and only for New York right
yeah.
now. You certainly do have some big and ambitious plans on the horizon. Tell our listeners about those.
We do. We are, with help from our lead funder on this project, Dick Cashin from One Equity Partners, we are breaking ground in about a year on a Norman Foster design with in collaboration with Bade Steigerberg Cox. They're our New York City architects.
Mm-hmm.
Breaking ground on a 14,000-square-foot community boathouse and learning center here in Manhattan. So the project's probably going to be about $25 million all in, and it's going to be this phenomenal, beautiful, meaningful, important, wonderful, fun boathouse in New York City for New York City, being designed by this world-renowned architect. And the vision is really to make it a place where 400 or 500 kids a day will be and you know, where will be their second home. And, you know, I'm unbelievably beyond excited about it because I think it's going to be such a gift to the city. And then to young people for generations to come in our city.
A very cool way to end. Well, Amanda Kraus, the founder and executive director of Roe New York, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. For people who want to learn more about the organization, your programs, how they can help and become involved, what is your website and what will they find there?
Yeah, so absolutely, folks, rowers or people interested in education or getting involved with Roe New York, our website is rownewyork.org, and it's R-O-W, and then New York is spelled out, newyork.org.
Well, thanks, Amanda. It was a delight to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Tiana was homeless and looking for a change. At Year Up, she gained valuable skills and a path to success. 85% of Year Up alumni are employed or in school within 4 months of graduation. Support transformative opportunities for young adults like Tiana. Visit yearup.org. Welcome back to The Business of Giving with Denver Frederick.
Have you ever really challenged yourself, both physically and mentally, to achieve a feat which at first glance looks beyond impossible? My next guest saw a newspaper ad for a charity bike ride from Boston to New York, all 286 miles, and took up the challenge, even though she had not been on a bike since junior high school. The end result was an organization called I Challenge Myself, and it's a pleasure to have with us its founder and executive director, Anna Reyes. Good evening, Anna, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Hi, Denver. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Let's begin, Anna, by having you tell us the mission and purpose of I Challenge Myself.
So I Challenge Myself's mission is to use cycling and fitness to help students develop socially, academically, and physically.
Let me pick up a little bit what I mentioned in the opening there, and that is you challenge yourself to take that bike ride from Boston to New York. What did you learn about yourself, and how did it fuel your energy to create this organization?
What I realized is that I was stronger than I thought I was, and that it's mind over matter. And when I finished, one of the first thoughts I had was, what if I had had this experience when I was in high school, having grown up in the South Bronx, and also first-generation American, and how would it have impacted the decisions that I made about myself and what I could become? And I really felt like, well, you know, somebody should start something or provide a similar experience to high school students like me.
And why not you to start it? So when you have an idea like that, where do you start? How did you begin, Anna?
It actually took 3 years for me to move on it. I felt initially that I was not the right person. I was in education reform. I had been a teacher before.
Right.
And honestly, I felt like I'm not an athlete. I can't really do this. And it took 3 years. And it was honestly having a conversation with a friend. And I was like, you know, I keep having this idea of starting this nonprofit and, you know, challenging students physically, but I can't do it. And he's like, well, Anna, you can. Like, you can hire somebody to teach the kids how to ride a bike. You've got other skills.
Mm-hmm.
And literally, it was just that conversation. I went home, I wrote it down. And when I wrote down the concept, I realized, like, you know, I actually could do it. There were a lot of the pieces. I already had a lot of the pieces together. So really, that was the first step.
Where did your first money come from? Because that's what stops a lot of people. How do you finance an idea like this?
We were very lucky. I would say that fate had a lot to do with it. We got our funding from the Laurier Sport for Good Foundation.
Mm.
It's a foundation that supports organizations like I Challenge Myself that uses sports as a tool for social change. And they gave us the seed money, and they're still one of our partners, and we lucked out.
The rest is history.
Yep.
Well, I Challenge Myself has three signature programs. So let me ask you about each if I could. The first is Cycling Smarts. What is that all about?
So Cycling Smarts introduces students to endurance bicycling and as a way of helping develop self-esteem, healthy lifestyles. It also really gets them out of their neighborhoods. What the goal of the program is to train the students for their first century ride, which is a 100-mile one-day bike tour. That's significant because a lot of our students a lot of times have only been like around the block. We have students who've never been on a bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
So to basically put themselves to be that vulnerable and go on this journey says a lot about them. But at the end, what we do see is that they do tend to feel more confident about themselves, not just physically stronger, but mentally stronger. Biking also really provides a great opportunity to build camaraderie.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they're outside of the city. They'll cross the GW Bridge. So you have to take care of one another. And so there's this feeling of being a family. And so that's really at the heart of that program is really about confidence, team building, and then taking that experience of going from either not riding a bike or just riding around the block and then progressively taking these small steps and getting stronger, riding longer, and then how do you, to reach this long-term ambitious goal, and then how do you turn that experience and transfer it to other goals that you have, graduating high school, college, and pursuing your careers?
Yeah, it sounds like a lot around goal setting.
It is.
And how to take a big idea and break it into little chunks and achieve it one step at a time.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And then surrounding yourself also with people that believe in you, your coach and your teammates.
Makes a big difference. The second, which I think is really cool, is the college bike tour across New York. Tell us about that.
So that's a program that takes about 10 students from the Cycling Smart students, 9th through 11th graders, who've successfully completed the program. And the idea is to basically expand their options of colleges outside of New York City. So they take the bus. They don't ride to Syracuse. But once they're in Syracuse, they visit seven colleges over 7 days, and they get to sleep in the dorms, they eat in the cafeteria, they get to meet with admissions officers. So again, it's just deepening, taking the biking program and then taking it to another level in terms of college access.
Mm-hmm. And your third program, which is one of the newer ones, would be Four to Fit. Now, how is that program coming along, and what does that entail?
So that program came out of what we saw when we were in high schools, and we were recruiting a lot of students from the physical education, the gym classes, and just seeing some of the basically these large PE classes with very little structure and not a lot of focus on skills building, not a lot of variety. And we wanted to take some of what we learned in the cycling program by giving kids a challenge that they're working towards, setting those goals. And then we really created this program that really teaches them the basics of fitness, how mm-hmm. to take care of your body so that if you want to lose weight, you know how to do that, or if you want to tone, but just how your muscles work, how your body works, and basically so that they can take care of themselves or take care of their bodies afterward. And we push in. It's a push-in program, so we provide a coach during the PE classes, and students go through four phases, control, movement, strength, and power. At mm-hmm. the end of each one, there's a challenge that they work towards. They actually create their own routines to demonstrate what they've learned.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about those challenges for a minute, because these are really not for sissies. These are pretty daunting. And I would imagine there are a lot of people along the way who want to drop out of these programs. I'm sure many of them probably do. But for those who succeed, what generally gets them through that wall that so many people will invariably hit?
That's a great question. And I remember a student coming back from this one, actually. We actually did a century ride to Bear Mountain and back. And I asked him, he said, missed. He's like, he really challenged himself. I was like, well, what kept you going? And the responses we get sometimes are their peers, so their teammates. And it's just something within themselves that just won't allow them to quit. And what we've learned is even some alumni, we did a survey of alumni, and one of the things that I found was that resonated the most was a number of students said that what stayed with them is that quitting is not an option. So I think it's both a combination of the people around them that were encouraging them not to quit, and then just something that's deep within that I think happens when you do challenge yourself, right? Like, you do make that choice of either to give up or continue, and it's finding that, giving people opportunity or kids that opportunity early on to develop that muscle.
Mm-hmm.
And you develop that over time. If you do it time and time and time again, it becomes easier. You know, it does become something that you get used to doing, just to overcoming those
challenges.
Yeah,
that's really very interesting. Yeah. I do think when you do it over and over again, those times you want to quit, you think back of other times that you wanted to quit, and somehow you made it through that time, and it gives you that inspiration or that energy to say, I thought I was going to quit then, and I made it. I'm at the same spot here. I know I can do this. There's
exactly.
a confidence that you can pull through.
Exactly. It's kind of like you're building this bank of confidence that
yeah.
you get to tap into whenever, you know, you do face a situation. And it could be physical or it could be some other challenge, really. But it's knowing that you have that ability to persevere and to overcome. And it's, quite frankly, being comfortable being uncomfortable. And part of it is, you know, getting young people to feel that and to celebrate that early on and to say that it's okay, right? It's okay to feel comfortable in a safe space, to mm-hmm. be uncomfortable. And what we've seen is that they do respond to that really well.
Yeah. Well, I challenge myself as not a stagnant organization, and you continue to evolve. And one of the elements you've now included in the program are pathways to careers. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. Yeah, so as an organization that right now is exclusively working with high school students and high school students who are predominantly Latino, African-American, first-generation American, first-generation going to college, we really wanted to figure out how do we go deeper. And one way that we saw that was just expanding students' perception of careers. So we have one program that's a mentoring program,
mm-hmm.
and that one really exposes students to about 40 plus paid high school internships available in New York City that include Metropolitan Museum of Art, Apollo Theater, Central Park Conservancy, Intrepid Museum, these amazing opportunities that are only available here.
Great organizations.
And when we realized, like, our students didn't know about them, and even when we were pushing them out on social media, there's so much noise that they weren't really paying attention. And even if they were, they may not have felt confident or know or really had the tools to apply for them. So that program pairs them with a mentor to really help them take advantage of those opportunities. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is called, it's the Pathways to Health and Fitness Careers. It's really targeting those students that are really into health and fitness and sports. And it's giving them the opportunity both to prepare and take the group fitness certification exam. There's the National Academy of Sports Medicine has this program, a curriculum that helps high school students take that exam. So one part is getting them ready for that. And then the other part is because they're in our cycling or Fortifit program, they actually get to apply what they're learning as an assistant fitness or cycling coach in their class. And then what we're looking for that is really looking at feeders programs, whether it's becoming a PE teacher, a group fitness trainer, and just a plethora of careers in the health and fitness field that are definitely underrepresented by people of color.
Right. So they can apprentice with you, more or less.
Correct.
Uh-huh.
Correct.
You mentioned high school students. You have some partnerships with high schools. How do they come about, and who are some of your partner high schools?
Right now we're partnering with four high schools in the South Bronx, Washington Heights, Lower East Side, and Gravesend.
Mm-hmm.
In the past, what we've done is we basically put out a request for applications, schools that were interested, and they applied. And, you know, there's a process that we go through, and just in terms of choosing the partners.
Do you measure the impact and the outcomes of the students who've been through your program and how they're doing?
Yes, we do. We actually do. We measure fitness, obviously, is one of them, mostly now around aerobic capacity and cardio. We also measure social and emotional growth.
Mm-hmm.
We're using a survey that's helping us with that. You know, measures confidence. And we also measure, like, cycling skills for the cycling program, attendance. So those are the major graduation rates, college graduation rates for the college bike tour students.
Yeah, looking at everything. You know, you mentioned your seed funder before, but who are some of your major financial supporters? And Anna, what's your pitch to them when you're going in there looking for some bucks?
So right now, so Laureus is still a funder after all these years. We also get funding from the New York Community Trust, the Heisman Trophy Award is another grantor. We have some money from the city. And then the other funding right now that we're getting are just donations and events.
Yeah.
So my pitch when I approach either foundations or mostly foundations or a grant is really basically to help us bring these unique opportunities to really help students embrace challenges as opportunities to learn and grow and really to develop socially, academically, and physically through biking and through fitness.
So. You know, you mentioned events before. I know you have a walk coming up this spring. Tell us about that and maybe some of the other events you have on the docket.
Sure. So we have a run walk in Prospect Park on May 19th, and people can sign up on our website. It's a really family-friendly event. It's organized by this wonderful organization called Generosity Series. We have 25 slots, so we're looking for people to help us. It's a crowdfunding event. And then we have an indoor cycling event at Equinox, East 53rd Street, and that will also be on our website shortly, that event. So those are two events that are coming up.
Mm-hmm. You know, I challenge myself. It's a relatively small organization. So, Anna, what are your biggest challenges on a day-to-day basis?
Wow. So the biggest, we're still, I would say, a bit understaffed. It's, I think a lot of it is operation support.
Mm-hmm.
So much of the funding that we get is focused on program. And so what we've struggled with is building infrastructure. So communications, marketing, You know, so those types of, you know, grants management, the things that nobody really wants to pay for because everybody wants to just focus on, obviously, the programs. But, you know, you can't run a business, right, without having an accountant, without having communications, without having really the back end support. And so I would say that that's right now the biggest challenge is as we've grown our programs, the infrastructure to support and really, you know, help us to leverage other types of funding or tell our story better is just not there.
Yeah.
And so we're kind of, it's piecemeal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's reflected in our marketing materials and, you know, in our on our website and in just other ways that's really holding us back.
Nothing like unrestricted funding.
Yes. So we definitely need to do a better job of that.
Yeah. On a personal note, do you have a challenge right now you're currently working on or considering?
A personal challenge. So I actually, crazy enough, I have been intrigued lately. Don't ask me how I came across, but I've been thinking about, I'm first generation American. So I and my siblings will be the first to be buried on American soil.
Mm-hmm.
And so this idea of, like, you know, what happens when you're the first and kind of severing, you know, that tie, like that
yeah.
familial tie. And so I've been curious, and I have a number of relatives that are, I'm Dominican, that live in, like, some are in Switzerland, they're in Europe and Berlin, and just starting a project. And I just literally, I'm at the very beginning to really look at Dominicans or Dominican women outside of Dominican Republic
mm-hmm.
and just what is that experience like for them, kind of with the same frame, that question about they're probably going to be the first and what does that mean either to them, to their children, and just kind of exploring that idea. So it's one of those things that it is a challenge because it's something that I've actually taken on as something that I want to do for myself, for my family, just part of just my own personal history and something that I feel I've neglected. So that's just one
yeah.
kind of out there challenge.
Well, it sounds very similar to the process you went through with I Challenge Myself. It kind of, you know, runs around your head for a couple years and you think
yeah.
about it and then one day execution
yeah.
and action
yeah.
Take place.
Yeah.
Let me close with this, Anna. I mean, we talked about the program and the kids who've been through it, but can you share with us a story of an individual who having gone through this program, it's really had an impact on their life and their future?
So I'm going to just mention this person because I just happened to be I live in Washington Heights, like I said, and one of our programs is there. So occasionally I'll run into
mm-hmm.
some of the students. And I ran into one of our alumni on Sunday and you know, he came up to me, and I remember this particular student because he was a little bit shy, but he had this dream of becoming a police officer. Like, his goal was NYPD, FBI. And he was also had recently arrived to New York, so his English wasn't, you know,
mm-hmm.
quite up to par. But he had that. And when I met him on Sunday, but he was in our program, and the program that we had at the time was really looking at a health issue affecting the community, and then they would create service learning projects, and
okay,
mm-hmm. and we really focused on elementary schools. I remember we did there was one around diabetes, and the kids had to create posters on just healthy eating, and so anyway, they had to facilitate, organize the whole thing. They led the workshops, and and so when I ran into him, and we've stayed in touch, but now he's an NYPD officer, and he started this program now where he's in the Bronx where they're working at a high school, and they're starting, I guess it's a volleyball league
uh-huh.
to basically help improve relationships between the police officers and the students. And I said, oh, you know, I was talking to him. I said, well, that sounds amazing. And he's like, well, you know, that started from his experience with I Challenge Myself, because he learns through our program the importance of giving back to the community and giving back to others. And so that just really, it was just one of those things that I just, I was like, okay, yeah, this is why you know, it's just, it makes everything worthwhile, right? Yeah. Like those moments where you literally just want to give up and like, why am I doing this?
Oh, sure.
But it was just, it was great to see that he pursued his dream regardless. And it's taken him a little while.
Yeah.
But he's, you know, he's still there. He's still aiming for FBI. Mm. And I think just to hear from him, the impact it had on also giving back to the community was something that
nice to
was,
see him pay it forward.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, Anna Reyes, the founder and executive director of I Challenge Myself, I want to thank you for being here this evening. Tell us about your website, what visitors will find there, how they can get involved with your organization.
Thank you. So the website is www.ichallengemyself.org. You'll find out about our programs. And if you go to the events tab, you can find out of all our events, but also volunteer. We're looking for volunteers to help mentor students, volunteers to help with the internship program that I mentioned to really help students prepare for that group fitness exam. Also, we need board members. We need people to volunteer to help on the cycling ride. So I would say in terms of ways that people get involved is check out our volunteers tab and check out the events tab. And obviously make a donation. We greatly appreciate that.
Unrestricted funding.
Unrestricted funding.
Thanks, Anna. It was great to have you on the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. This was a pleasure.
Johnny, that's better than most. That is better than most. Better than most!
Better Than Most is a regular feature of The Business of Giving, examining the best places to work among social businesses and nonprofit organizations.
And this evening, you will be going up to Bronxville, New York, and to the offices of the One Love Foundation. We will begin with their chief executive officer, Katie Hood, and then you'll hear from some of the other members of the team.
So there's a very can-do vibe in the office, and I think there's also a sense that we want everyone to realize their own power to make a difference, and we realize our own power to make a difference.
But, you know, I was very surprised and really grateful that everyone was so welcoming and so nice when I started, and are still today, of course. But the vibe here is very relaxed. Everyone's working hard. Everyone's trying to get everything they can get done. But still, there's just a level of, like, chill productivity here, I would describe it as.
I would say something about One Love that no one would know unless they worked here was how few people do this mass amount of work. We're a relatively small operation. We have, I think, outsized brand recognition for the number of people that work here. I get that impression from people, like when I'm interviewing them or when I'm talking to people about One Love, they say, oh, you must have a network of thousands or something all over the, you know, they think we're Salvation Army or something like that. It's really just a few very focused, hardworking, dedicated people.
Down from leadership, they seek everyone's opinion and they keep everybody in the know of what's going on, you know, like letting everybody know the decisions that are being made and in making them feel included and getting feedback. So that's kind of how I feel like they're being collaborative.
I think that is because we are still quite a young organization. And so when you're young and you're trying to grow quickly, initiative is rewarded. And that is something that even 4 or 5 years in, initiative is still very much rewarded. And when you think of where our big partnerships breakthroughs have come from, really big initiatives like working with entire school districts, some of that just came from someone entry level picking up the phone and calling a top person at a school district. And you just see what happens.
I think we all feel this sense of urgency, and that's something that Katie says again and again. We feel the pressure to really change this culture and in a positive way, and that's what Sharon Love also said. We have to make this movement positive, and we have to include people that have never been included before necessarily.
There's one thing that our CEO said in one of those calls, and she basically said when you walk into the door at One Love, just try to envision what you're going to do for the day as if you're in my shoes. So her just saying that was very impactful for me because it showed me that no matter where you are in the organization, everyone wants you to like step it up a level and see things from basically the CEO's perspective, and it shows you like how much of an impact you're really making.
Even just this week, and also thinking about how we're allowed to have ideas and run with them, we are working with a woman to make sure that our trainings are accessible for the population that's deaf or hard of hearing. And we're working with her so that we have trainings available for our content that are in American Sign Language. And that's something that we haven't done before, but that's incredibly important.
We get a week off in the month of July, and our leadership team actually like brainstormed that idea, and I think it's amazing because basically the goal of it is like we should not be checking any, I mean we can if we want to, but the goal is like to not check any emails, to just really focus in on yourself and do things that really, you know, ignite that fire within you. Or if you just want to relax, you could relax, but we have 1 week off just to unplug and just to do our thing. So I think that's amazing. So thank you for that.
It's about who brings the best perspectives. And I would say that our increase in our cultural competency as an organization, it did not happen by accident, right? It's a concerted effort among many different people, mostly led by Jen. It's only going to happen if you make it happen.
I'd say on the flip side, in terms of when a position is open, another thing that is unique about One Love is that we don't rush to just fill that position exactly the way it was before. I think we take the time whenever there's an opening to really understand what the needs of the organization are. You know, we're growing rapidly. We're still a young organization. We've been in this current form for, you know, not even quite 4 years. So things are growing and changing. And so when there is an opening, taking that time to understand what are the organizational needs, and is it that same exact position, or would there be a position that might be more beneficial, you know, that might be a little bit of a change or a big change. But I think we use every opening as a chance to say, what's the best thing for the organization?
We not only are thinking always about our relationships within the workplace, how we're working together, how we're collaborating, which everyone has touched on, but we think a lot about the people that we interact with every day. Whether it's the first time someone's reached out on our website, we really think about how quickly are we getting back to them, what resources are we giving them to be helpful.
I would say another thing that like helps with that is our seating and our office space. I mean, we're all in together. You know, there are no, like, there's very few offices, like, where people have private offices, and we're kind of just all seated together. When I first started, it was a little uncomfortable to pick up the phone and know that the person across the room from me was going, "It's okay that you stumbled on that call. Oh, God, everybody can hear me." But, like, even Katie, our CEO, like, will scream out from her office, and she'll be like, "Hey, did anybody tell Kiki about the phones being down?" Like, we're all like kind of like everybody can hear each other, everybody can talk, and I don't know, like sometimes it helps, sometimes it doesn't. But I feel like it does help with, like, if you overhear something, then you'll turn and go, "Oh, well," and, you know, like, and it sparks conversation, or it sparks like collaboration, because then you can kind of talk to each other.
And I think part of that is actually structure, physical structure. So, for example, we have a room in our office called the bullpen. There's no windows. It's not particularly bright. You wouldn't think it's, you know, the best spot to have a desk in the office necessarily, or in one of our offices, I should say. But there were a number of people at one point, and still now, about 8 or 9 people who have desks in that space, who do a lot of the same work, are sort of on the same level. And so, especially when everyone is in there, it's a little bit crazy, but it's very energetic. And I think it flows between people sort of shouting out questions. How have you gone about this situation? How have you handled this when you've come across it? All the way to, "Did you guys see this article? I can't believe this." And like, "Okay, this podcast like is amazing," or "This show, unhealthy relationship. Did you guys see that?"
Like Erica mentioned, we have such a collaborative atmosphere, especially in the bullpen, where you just turn around and you're asking questions and you're getting feedback from people. And so by the time sometimes I send one email, at least 3 other people have looked at it, because we really care about what's going into our work.
Well, one thing that we do here that I've never done before is that we choose who we want to write about of our coworkers, and then our coworkers choose who they want to write about. So you are 360, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what it's called. At first, I was very overwhelmed by that when the first time I had to do it, and I was very annoyed. But then once I saw it actually happen and and saw the benefit, I realized that it's definitely something that we should keep doing. I think.
And the same is happening across the organization, so that when we're talking about the 10 signs of a healthy relationship, it would be hypocritical of us to not bring those into the workplace. And that's something I truly appreciate about One Love. You're not going to hear people screaming at other people. You're not going to hear yelling. You're not going to get a lot of passive aggression that you might in another setting. We really look at those 10 signs and we say, how are we going to apply those to not only our personal relationships and our relationships externally, but also with one another?
I would like to extend my thanks to all those who participated in this piece. Jaleesa Tucker, Manisha Serene, Jennifer Lescott, Annie Forrest, Greg Clements, Erica Becker, and Shara Salgado Easter. To hear this again, read the transcript, or see pictures of the participants and offices, come to denver-frederick.com, where we'll post a link to my full interview with Katie Hood, the Chief Executive Officer of One Love. And that is this week's show. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, and I hope you'll return next Sunday evening for the Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of the Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.